Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 10, Jews Not for Jesus. Last episode, we looked at how the apostolic fathers and early apologists like Ignatius and Aristides dealt with heresy, persecution, and parish life. We also saw how the emperors themselves handled the legal question of the church. In this episode, we return to the Holy Land. In 132 AD, another great revolt against the Roman Empire broke out in Judea. This war was even larger than the previous revolt. Simon Bar Kokhba was hailed as Messiah by many rabbis in Judea. For the next 3 years, he waged war against Rome and set up a kingdom. But before we dive into that conflict, we need to take a few steps back to examine the state of the Jerusalem church on the eve of the revolt. As I noted back in episode 7, after James's martyrdom, his cousin Simeon Bar Cleopas was made bishop of Jerusalem. The Jerusalem church fled the city during the first Judean revolt and migrated to Pella, on the other side of the Jordan. Now I need to make a few corrections here. Simeon was more likely made bishop shortly after James was murdered, not when the community decided to leave Pella to return home. Furthermore, the Hebrew mother church likely stayed in Pella since Jerusalem was an uninhabited, smoldering pile of ruins. Therefore, Simeon was bishop of Jerusalem in exile. To refresh, a man named Theophilus, because he was not chosen as bishop, began to try to corrupt the church, and most likely some sort of doctrinal schism occurred between him and Simeon. Some scholars suggest that this schism lies at the origins of the two groups of Jewish Christians that appear in subsequent history, the Nazarenes and the Ebionites, whom I shall discuss later. Nonetheless, while Simeon and the family of Jesus were still around, heretics could do very little to poison the Hebrew mother church. The Jerusalem community, and the other native Jewish Christians of the Holy Land, particularly in Galilee, had a strong sense of their identity. They were Israel's righteous remnant, led by the family of the Messiah himself. Their fellow Judeans had failed to heed the Messiah's words and warnings, and thus failed in their war against Rome. Among the Jewish groups that survived the first war, the Jerusalem church had a clear understanding and coherent theology for a faith without a physical temple. The true Messiah had come, fulfilled the prophecies of the Hebrew scriptures, and predicted the destruction of the temple, as both a divine judgment and a vindication of himself. Their fellow Israelites needed to repent and recognize the true Messiah. As we saw in episode 7, the rabbis, heirs of the Pharisees, were also producing a theology for a temple-less Judaism. The actions of the rabbis in defining a new Jewish orthodoxy would do much in the way of separating the church from Judaism. Again, to refresh, in the late 1st century, the rabbis held a council in Jamnia, which forbid the Septuagint and the new Christian scriptures. Christians, Jewish or Gentile, were to be cursed in the synagogues, the so-called benediction of the heretics. Rabbi Gamaliel II is said to have ordered this curse to be recited 3 times a day. Gamaliel was also hailed as Nasi, or Patriarch, Prince, of the Jewish people, much to the chagrin of the descendants of King David, like Jesus' family. Another rabbi at this time, Tarpon, is supposed to have said he would rather flee to a pagan temple than enter the house of a Christian. The Christian scriptures, the texts which would become the New Testament, Tarpon is recorded to have said he would burn, even if God's name was written in them. Indeed, the great rabbi Akiba declared damnation for any Jew who dare to read any Christian books. Simeon may have been a great Jewish leader, but his contemporaries, Ben Zakkai, Gamaliel II, and Akiba were determined enemies. When they met at Jamnia, the rabbis were only a small group with little influence, but eventually they would come to lead and define the Jewish faith. Rabbinic tradition records an intriguing account about these times. One day, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was walking along the main street of Sepphoris, where he met a Jewish Christian, Jacob of Kephar Siknin. Jacob shared some teachings with Eliezer, probably the Gospel. The rabbinic source states that Jacob spoke in the name of Yeshu ben Pantiri. More on that name later. Eliezer actually liked what he heard, and even repeated it. Before he knew it, he was charged with heresy, or more accurately, Christianity, and brought before the Roman magistrate. Eliezer was released, but the event horrified him. Why was he arrested? Then it came to him. He had not only allowed himself to listen to the teachings of a Christian, but he had even conversed with said Christian. Worst of all, Eliezer actually liked what he heard, so much so he repeated it. Later, Eliezer is recorded as saying, "Let a man always flee from what is disgusting, and from that which resembles what is disgusting." The story illustrates many teaching lessons the rabbis wish to convey to their followers. Christianity is disgusting. Christians are to be avoided. Don't even let yourself hear them speak. Christianity is not only a disgusting heresy, but illegal. The Roman imperial authorities may punish you for it, even if you are a great rabbi. The rabbis were determined to drive a big hulking wedge between the accursed followers of Jesus and themselves. The positive side of this story is that Eliezer, before he was disciplined for his crime, actually liked what he heard from Jacob. He actually found Christian teaching pleasing, something that horrified himself and his colleagues. Another negative facet of this story is the reference to Jesus as Yeshu ben Pantiri. The name is a double insult to Jesus himself. Yeshua is Jesus' actual Semitic name, whereas Yeshu is a Hebrew acronym that curses him. The son of Pantiri is a reference to one of the rabbinic slurs about Jesus' family, that Jesus was not virgin-born, but the product of an adulterous affair between Mary and a Roman soldier named Pantera. Over the next few centuries, the rabbis would further develop a sort of counter-narrative to the Christian gospel, which attacked Jesus personally. We will explore this in the future. Simeon was eventually martyred around the same time as Ignatius of Antioch. Just as Domitian, when he investigated Jews' grandsons, Trajan too was concerned about Davidic messianism. Some of the followers of Theopompus accused Simeon of being a Davidic descendant. The schismatics were themselves Davidites, and so were probably trying to both get revenge on Simeon and avoid persecution. Upon hearing this about Simeon, the Roman governor of Judea, Atticus, ordered the Hebrew bishop to be tortured. At this time, Simeon was alleged to have been 120 years old, the Torah's limit on human life, and the age of Moses. In rabbinic tradition, Ben Zakkai and Akiba were also said to have lived this long, further reflecting the rivalry between these two Jewish groups. Despite his extreme old age, Simeon endured all the torment Atticus laid upon him. Simeon's endurance bore witness and amazed all, even Atticus himself. The governor finally had had enough and ordered the Israelite saint to be crucified. And so, Simeon bar Cleopas, cousin of the Messiah, heir of James the Righteous, and bishop of Jerusalem for over 40 years, earned the crown of martyrdom. After Simeon's death, leadership of the Jerusalem church fell into the hands of a certain Justus. The sources here, though, present a problem. Between Simeon's martyrdom, about the year 107, and the end of the Second Jewish War, 135, 13 Hebrew bishops are said to have reigned in this 28-year period, which would make them all, on average, bishops for only 2 years each. This seems dubious. Were they all just very short-lived? What's going on here? A convincing explanation put forward by Richard Baucom is that Justus was the actual presiding bishop, and the other 12 bishops form something of a council. Now that we are finally caught up, it's time to return to AD 132, when the Second Jewish-Roman War began. Rabbi Akiba came to believe that a man named Simon Bar Kosaba was possibly the Messiah, and so changed his name from Bar Kosaba to Bar Kokhba, meaning Son of the Star, a reference to the Messianic prophecy in Numbers 24:17. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. If you want a more detailed account of the war, see episode 83 of Mike Duncan's The History of Rome. May his bones be crushed. As far as we are concerned, Bar Kokhba rebelled in 132 AD and ruled Judea as Nasi, or prince, for 3 more years until Hadrian's legions finally defeated him. The causes of the war are disputed. Hadrian at some point refounded Jerusalem as a new Roman colony, Aelia Capitolina, a pagan city. A temple to Jupiter was built on the Temple Mount, and circumcision was outlawed. Were these measures taken before or after the revolt? Personally, I am inclined to think before, and so these measures provide the catalyst for Bar Kokhba's war. The results of this war for the Hebrew Mother Church were catastrophic. The first of these consequences was Bar Kokhba's persecution of Jewish believers. The reason for Bar Kokhba's persecution were probably twofold. On the one hand, it was Akiba and the rabbis who backed his messianic claims, and we all know how the rabbis felt about the church. Second, Bar Kokhba believed himself to be God's Messiah, which in effect meant that to not support his war, or to acknowledge his claim as Messiah, was treason against the nation of Israel. The church did both. The Christians of Judea, just as in the first revolt, did not participate in the war, and the Jewish Christians already acknowledged Jesus of Nazareth as Israel's promised king. In the eyes of the rabbis and their Messiah, Jewish Christians were the worst of traitors. Bar Kokhba took severe actions against any Jew who did not support him. Remember how zealous Paul had been to persecute the church back in episode 2? Dissident Israelites were worse than pagans themselves. Christians, particularly in Galilee, suffered greatly. Bar Kokhba ordered that unless Christians denied Jesus was the Messiah, he would subject them to cruel punishments. An apocryphal Christian text, the Apocalypse of Peter, appears to have been written by a Jewish believer during Bar Kokhba's persecution. The text portrays the Jewish Christians as the righteous remnant of Israel, the true heirs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Bar Kokhba is viewed as a wicked messianic pretender. Their ethnic brethren were united against them under a false Christ. Another objective of Bar Kokhba's was to capture Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. Jewish Christians obviously gave no support to this either. Jesus had prophesied its destruction. The Apocalypse of Peter presents God as promising Jesus' followers entrance into the heavenly temple. In the end, Hadrian defeated the rabbinic savior. The loss of life on both sides was enormous. Judea was renamed Palestina after the Philistines, Israel's ancient enemy. Abrahamic Jerusalem would remain pagan, Alia Capitolina, until the time of Constantine. Jews were forbidden to enter Jerusalem or the neighboring area, a prohibition that would stand until the end of Roman rule in Palestine, when the armies of Islam took the city 500 years later. The ban also applied to Jewish Christians. After the war, there were no longer Hebrew bishops of Jerusalem, but only Gentile bishops of Alia Capitolina. From this time forward, Jewish Christians play a minor role in our story, popping up infrequently here and there. Jerusalem, as a center of Christianity, decreased in importance. The church at large would no longer look to the holy city for leadership and guidance as they once had. What happened to the Jewish Christian survivors? As I alluded to earlier, the two groups of Jewish Christians that appear in subsequent history are the Nazarenes and the Ebionites. The Ebionites were a heretical group of Judaizers. Their origins perhaps lie in the schismatic Theobothus, or even earlier, with the Judaizers the Apostle Paul had to combat. The Ebionites rejected Paul and all his teachings. To them, he was the arch-heretic. They held to the Gospel of Matthew in its original Aramaic version. They believed that both Jews and Gentiles needed to keep the Torah to be justified. Finally, they denied the divinity of Christ and the virgin birth. To the Ebionites, Jesus was a mortal man, the natural son of Joseph and Mary, and adopted by God as his son during his baptism. The reason they rejected the virgin birth, besides rejecting Jesus' divinity, was the importance of Jesus' biological descent from David. If Joseph was a descendant of David, then Jesus needed to be his natural son, to also be the son of David. That is who the Ebionites were. The other group was the Nazarenes. The Nazarenes, while they kept the Torah, did not believe Gentiles needed to keep it. As far as doctrine was concerned, they were in agreement with the church at large. They accepted Jesus' divinity and the Apostle Paul. The Nazarenes were thus the descendants of the apostolic Jewish church, led by James and Simeon and Justus. What happened to them? Well, they moved again, this time up north into Syria. Berea in Coal Syria, Aleppo, and Laodicea by the river Orontes. Laodicea is below a coastal mountain range, which is still known today as the Valley of the Nazarenes. The subsequent history of the Nazarenes is one of the most tragic outcomes of the so-called parting of ways between Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism. While the rabbis hated them as traitors and heretics, slowly over time, Gentile Christians would begin to regard them as heretics too, because of their observance of Mosaic law. While some early Gentile writers regarded the Nazarenes as part of the church, as the centuries progressed, more would come to see them as schismatics. We will see this shift in future episodes. Speaking of the parting of ways, the Bar Kokhba revolt represents a turning point in the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. Now, in recent decades, historians have moved away from the parting of ways perspective, where Jews and Christians split from each other very clearly in the 2nd century. Instead, scholars today tend to emphasize how Jews and Christians continued to interact and influence one another. Well into the 4th century, Christians would still be attracted to Judaism. There are instances where ordinary Christians and Jews, despite the wishes of bishops and rabbis, mingled with one another, even leading to degrees of religious syncretism. But despite all this, it is hard not to see the Bar Kokhba revolt as the culmination of deteriorating Jewish-Christian relations. Jesus had disputed Judaism with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Some among these groups became enemies of his and were highly involved in his crucifixion as a false prophet and messianic pretender. The subsequent gospel proclamation by the apostles of his resurrection and the salvation he offered was met by some Jews with acceptance, but others with violence. Paul was repeatedly persecuted across the diaspora. The execution of James the Apostle was met with approval, and the brutal martyrdom of Jesus' brother, James, demonstrated the depth of this resentment. Non-Christian Jews in Rome distanced themselves from the church, making it easier for Nero to persecute. After the First War, the rabbis were intent on creating a Judaism where Jesus of Nazareth and his followers had no place. Eventually, their views would become the orthodoxy of Judaism. Bar Kokhba put these views into action and persecuted Jewish believers. As time went on, rabbis would create a version of Jesus' life that undermined and cursed him. As we shall see in future episodes, Bar Kokhba's war was not the last time non-Christian Jews would persecute Christians. Combining all this with the ever-increasingly Gentile church, is it any wonder that Judaism and Christianity parted ways? One of the first texts to witness to this so-called parting is the Epistle of Barnabas. Of course, Barnabas clearly did not write it, given the hostility it shows to Judaism and its harsh attitude towards the rituals of Old Testament law. In the Epistle of Barnabas, we see the beginnings of Christian supersessionism, the belief that the church has replaced the Jews as God's covenant people. The rabbis repudiated any claims by Christians, Gentile or Jewish, to be God's people. Now the church would start to say the same thing back, but in reverse. The calamities of the Jewish wars against Rome served to reinforce this view. If God's people were still the Jews, why did he not save the temple from Titus, or rescue the nation from Hadrian's wrath? This should not be taken to mean all Christian mission to Jews ended. Around the year 140 AD, a Christian named Aristo of Pella wrote a tract called Discussion Between Jason and Papskius Concerning Christ. Only fragments survive, but from later summaries, we learn that Aristo's apology to Jews purports to tell how a Jewish Christian named Jason debates a Jew from Alexandria named Papskius, and tries to prove from the Old Testament that Jesus is the Messiah. Papskius is eventually converted and receives baptism. Aristo's story of a debate between a Jew and a Christian would become a popular device used in later Christian polemics against Judaism. However, as the decades rolled by, the rhetoric of Christian apologetic would steadily become more harsh and aggressive. We will see this as we go on. Next episode, we will take a break from the narrative to discuss a religious movement that will be the greatest set of heresies the church has faced yet. A religious tradition whose interactions with the church fathers would leave a profound mark on Catholic orthodoxy. I am talking, of course, about Gnosticism. Thank you for listening. Please comment, review, and subscribe. You can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.